You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of May, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Andrew Tuck, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Raffaello, what do you have for us today?
So this morning we're going to talk about Thein Sein's visit, the Myanmar president, to the United States. We're going to talk about Li Keqiang's visit to Pakistan. And we're going to talk about the EU's decision to maybe list Hezbollah as a terrorist organization.
We'll also be finding out why a leading criminologist believes you may be born pre-programmed for a life of violent crime.
Two new brain imaging studies have come out showing that by looking at brain structure and brain function, we can better predict which prisoners are going to reoffend.
That's slightly scary, I think. We'll also head to Egypt to hear how a new company, Nile Taxi, is helping commuters to dodge Cairo's horrendous traffic.
We have a lot of problems in the traffic, in the Roman traffic in Egypt. So we decided, why not using the Nile as a mean of transportation for passengers.
Plus love, war and railways. We'll get the latest news from the Balkans from our man there, Guy Delaunay.
So all that plus we'll play some great music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So a very busy 60 minutes coming up, but before all that, let's check in with Paul Osborne for the latest world news.
The search of the ruins left by a huge tornado that hit the U.S. state of Oklahoma is now drawing to a close. Officials have said they're almost certain there are no more survivors or bodies left to recover. The storm killed 24 people, including 9 children, when it tore through Moore, a suburb of Oklahoma City. The governor of Oklahoma, Mary Fallin, expects the total number of deaths to rise.
We know that there are people that and bodies have been taken to the medical examiner's office, but we have also heard that there may be bodies that have been taken to local funeral homes. And so we are working real hard right now to try to get a more accurate count of the loss of life, and we hope to have better numbers on that.
A summit of EU leaders in Brussels today is likely to be dominated by the tax affairs of some of the world's largest companies. It's estimated European nations lose around €1 trillion every year through tax avoidance measures. On Tuesday, the head of the technology company Apple appeared before a US Senate committee to reject claims that it tried to shirk its tax responsibilities. But Senator John McCain, a member of the US Treasury Committee, said the company was exploiting failings in the tax system.
I will not allow that position to be used as an excuse to turn a blind eye to the highly questionable tax strategies used by Apple. The general American public should not have to make up the balance as corporations avoid paying billions in U.S. taxes. The egregious loopholes that exist in the tax code must be closed so that the nearly $1 trillion in untaxed overseas profits can come back to the United States.
North Korea has sent a special envoy to China to try to heal relations between the two countries. It follows Beijing's tougher stance against Pyongyang's latest nuclear test and heightened tension on the Korean Peninsula. A top North Korean military official flew to the Chinese capital earlier today. A Senate panel has approved plans for wide-ranging reform of U.S. immigration law. The changes are designed to give millions of people currently in America illegally a chance of citizenship. The full Senate will debate the proposal next month. Two leading political figures in Iran have been banned from standing in next month's presidential election. The former president Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani and Esfandiar Rahim Mashai, a close ally of the outgoing president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, both wanted to stand. But it's reported that Iran's Guardian Council approved just 8 of the almost 700 people who'd registered as potential candidates. There have been protests in Manila against reports that Filipino workers have faced violence in Taiwan. It follows the dispute between the Philippines and Taiwan over the killing of a Taiwanese fisherman who was shot dead by the Philippines Coast Guard in disputed waters. Around 85,000 Filipinos work in Taiwan. Wilson Hotaleza is from the Philippines Labour Party.
All migrants in the world, not only in Taiwan, are protected by international conventions, and they should not be made a scapegoat or any excuse for retaliatory actions between the two governments. Philippine government should conduct their impartial investigation and finish it immediately so that it cools everything.
Seven members of Egypt's security forces who've been abducted in the Sinai Peninsula have been freed. They were seized while traveling close to the city of El Arish. Men were released after Egypt's president ruled out any negotiations with their captors. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. We'll see you back at the bottom of the hour with another check of the world news headlines. It is 5 minutes past 8 o'clock in the morning here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you need to know over the next 24 hours. Joining us in the studio today is Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Raffaello, thank you very much for coming in to see us. Now we're going to start with this story about the Chinese Premier's heading to Pakistan, and he made a comment already ahead of his visit there saying that Pakistan was their iron brother and commending them for defending their territorial integrity, for being a great supporter of peace and stability within the region. Yeah. Is he visiting a different country to where everybody else knows about? Because these are not the kind of the endorsements that other countries have at the moment about Pakistan. We see it as a supporter through the back door of the Taliban in Afghanistan. All sorts of things going on that we were concerned about. But why is he so positive about Pakistan?
Well, the Chinese have got a very long-standing and strong relationship with the Pakistanis. Another wonderful piece of rhetoric which they constantly use, they describe their relationship as being higher than any mountain, deeper than any ocean, sweeter than honey, stronger than steel.
Sounds like a Diana Ross song.
I know, it's incredible. But but the point being that this is a really a relationship where the two will say, you know, we're not allies, we're brothers. And the Chinese have always said that, you know, well, Pakistan really needs one ally in the world, one person that it can absolutely rely on. And China sees itself in that role. This comes off the back of Premier Lee's visit to India, which was, you know, overshadowed by the border disputes that they've had with the Indians. But, you know, in some, it seems to be mostly a trade mission on the Chinese side. And so in some ways, the Chinese realize that they probably have to visit Pakistan afterwards to reassure the Pakistanis, who get very nervous about a burgeoning relationship with India and China that they see maybe leaves them out.
And it is quite fascinating because these foreign visits by leaders, they don't usually happen when a government is in transition. Usually the government is in place for several months before someone comes to visit them. So I guess that really does underline the importance of this visit. And as you mentioned, it's all about trade. Yeah. Trade between the two countries up on 12-month highs. I think it was up some 18%. Do we know what is going to be discussed? I'm guessing military hardware is one of the things at the top of the agenda?
Yes. Well, military hardware is part of the agenda. I would say that probably economics and trade will be the main thing that will walk away from this this whole thing. And it's a show of support. I don't think we should underplay the importance of that. It really is a show of support by the Chinese or the Pakistanis. But at the same time, I think we should realize that this is probably the Chinese checking in to see what's going on. They want to touch base with all the leaders who are there, all the new administration that's coming in, to get a sense of how things are going. Because while they talk in these sort of very highfalutin rhetorical terms between themselves about their relationship, there is a deep sense of concern in Beijing about what is happening in Pakistan and how things are not really going how one would like, how the security problems that you talk about are something that they're genuinely concerned about. They will never talk about it publicly. So in a way, going now during this period of transition means that they can go there and sort of reassure everyone and make sure that the stability will continue. And to say that, you know, we're not going to pull out all our investments and all our funding. We will continue to support you, whoever's in charge. And I think that's important. And they see this as a very crucial thing for Pakistan. I think, frankly, the international community is very grateful for the Chinese to continue to play this role, because it means that, you know, Pakistan gets a lot of stick elsewhere in the world because of many of the things you mentioned earlier. And so in a way, the Chinese sort of having this constant support and this constant rhetorical push and this constant economic support is important.
Just before we move on, we've seen over the past year or two, the Chinese trying to lease ports and harbours on the Pakistani coast. Mm. And that's both for kind of trade and for a place for its military to kind of, its navy to dock as well. Now, is that one of the main reasons that they're there as well, that they want to secure these deals? Because, as you say, they're playing a very complicated game when India and Pakistan are so concerned about each other, so concerned about military links. They have, you know, all these border disputes. It's a very tricky game for him to play. Is this why he has to kind of talk it up more and more each place that the premier visits?
Well, I think that the port that you referred to, the Gwadar port, is significant in military terms, but I think maybe less so than is often made out in the press. I think it is an issue which is one where, you know, this port has been beset with problems. The Chinese initially invested a lot of money in it, many hundreds of millions. It was run by the Singapore Authority. They had a lot of difficulty with the local government who wouldn't let them do certain things. And this is down in Balochistan, which is a part of Pakistan that's had a civil war essentially happening in it for years. But it's seen as a large investment that could help revitalize economically the area. So I actually think that in many ways the economics of that port are probably the more important element. Also because if they get that port up and running and the roads that and the pipelines that they're planning that will go from there right up into China, then you're giving the Chinese a new way to get their products from Xinjiang out into the sea.
And just one more question on Pakistan. How much do you think this is about an opportunity for China? And when I say that, an opportunity to reassert its position and its relationship within Asia, and particularly take that relationship, pivot the relationship with Pakistan and the U.S. Away from the Americans and to Beijing?
Well, I think that to be honest, the pivot, when we're talking about Pakistan in particular, it's always been Beijing focused. They've always had this fraught relationship with the Americans, and the Beijing axis has always been a very, very important one there. I think that, however, there's an interesting element in what you're saying, which is that this idea of China, what was talked about in 2005 is China's responsible stakeholder in international affairs. And in many ways, what you can see with their relationship with Pakistan is they're kind of doing it, but in their own way. You know, they can see that there is a role that they have to play with Pakistan because of the strong relationship they have and the importance of the country for the broader region. And they're trying to figure out, well, how can we do this in a way that isn't too sort of imperialist and expansionist, but at the same time, you know, maintains our sort of Chinese line.
Now, your second agenda setter for us today, Raphael, is about Britain asking the EU to put Hezbollah's armed wing on a terror list. Now, this follows an attack that happened in July last year in Bulgaria when a tour bus carrying Israelis was targeted, and it's claimed by the Bulgarian government this was done by Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. But when you read this story, God, what a murky story. So the Bulgarians say that they're not calling for this to happen. Mm-hmm. The French say that to do it would kind of upset politics in Lebanon. Hezbollah say it's nothing to do with them. And behind it all, you begin to wonder why is the UK pushing for this and whether this has anything to do with the fact that Hezbollah is now incredibly involved in the conflict in Syria. Mm. So there's so much realpolitik going on here and so much murky manoeuvring. Yeah. What's your reading of it?
I think it is a very murky story. I think you put your finger on the button there. I think that the issue is here that the UK in particular is pushing this. The UK has listed the military unit of Hezbollah already. It's a proscribed terrorist organization in the United Kingdom. You know, how do you define the political wing versus the military wing is a difficult question to parse. However, after the Burgas incident, which, you know, a lot of people have, I think even Europol has said it looks very heavily like this was a Hezbollah-directed organization. And then in Cyprus, there was a case recently of a chap there who was convicted of being a member of Hezbollah who confessed to being part of a whole network of cells that were doing stuff within the European Union. And so from a British perspective, there's a sense, you know, this is a terrorist organization and we should list it. The French and the Swedes are the ones who seem to be pushing back and saying absolutely not. And their concern is the fact of, well, what does this mean for the broader relationship with Beirut and with what's happening in Lebanon at the moment? And in fact, what's happening in Syria as well? Because in Syria, you have got a lot of stories and a lot of evidence, growing evidence of Hezbollah fighters going in there and supporting the Assad regime. And so the dilemma becomes, you know, where who wants what side to advance the other? I mean, the French and the Brits are very much in sync on what's happening in Syria. However, when you look at Lebanon, where the French have a very heavy investment and very sort of historically strong link, they would say, well, if we list all of Hezbollah, which is a party which has a political wing, which is very powerful, then who knows what this will do to the country's politics? It's already a very fractured place. So I think that it's a very complicated sort of picture, which I don't think one could definitively say is one thing or another. I think from a British perspective, they look at this and they say, well, this is a group that has carried out a terrorist attack in the European Union. So this is simple. Prescribe them.
And your third story, which we should have a look at, is Myanmar and the recent visit by their leader to Washington, D.C. with Obama.
Yes, well, this is, you know, Myanmar has been a big story in the press recently. It continues to sort of slowly open up. And the sort of biggest latest signal of this is President Thein Sein visiting Washington. It's the first time a leader from that country has visited in quite some time. And President Obama was quite open about describing it as Myanmar in his discussion rather than talking about Burma, which is there's some contention about the name. But I think that this is important because, you know, Myanmar is very much, I think, the United States increasingly seeing it as an example of how they would like countries to open up, former sort of authoritarian regimes, how they can open up. But what's interesting is if you put this back into an Asian context, and in many ways what we're talking about China-Pakistan before applies here as well. The Chinese have always been historically the ones who were more invested into Burma, or Myanmar, however you want to call it. but now we can see that there is a growing sense of concern from the Chinese side about what is happening. They've had a lot of difficulties with some of their big investments there. They've got a big mine which had to be shut down recently, a copper mine, by a company called Norinco, which had to be shut down because of local protests. There's a big pipeline that they're planning to build across the country, which has been held up, and CNPC, the company that's behind it, been having all sorts of problems, and they've recently said they're going to do a big CSR push. Well, why are the Chinese doing this? I mean, this used to be their domain. But now, because the country has opened up and because the United States and the European Union focus so much political attention and sort of economic interest on the country, this has, you know, changed the dynamics regionally for the Chinese and for others.
Rafael, unfortunately, that's all the time we have there. We could discuss this forever, I think. Rafael Pantucci, Senior Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Thanks for coming in and setting the day's agenda.
Thank you.
Now, after this short break, we're going to be dodging between Brussels and Dublin to discuss a growing row over tax.
When it comes to retail, the Taiwanese capital's independent shops are increasingly worthy of attention. Monocle's filmmaker wandered down side streets to discover a myriad of new small shops, each with a concept totally their own.
The name for the Pinmo Pure Store came to founder Richard Wong in a dream. It too is a hybrid, a tiny space on a residential street in the Da'an district that carries paper goods and clothing. A design agency shares the space, and tea and cookies are available even though there's no space to sit down.
Changing the city's retail landscape, one little shop at a time. Taipei Retail, in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
And welcome back. It's currently 8:17 here in London. Now, later today, EU leaders will gather in Brussels for a summit to discuss tax policy and Europe's energy market. The fight against tax evasion is high on the agenda today after finance ministers from Luxembourg and Austria last week blocked efforts to reach an agreement on sharing tax data. Each year, tax evasion costs EU states 1 trillion euros, and a European Parliament resolution has called on the EU to halve this figure by 2020 through stricter control of tax loopholes and havens.
Now, while EU leaders attempt to find a resolution against fiscal fraud and tax evasion, Ireland has come under particular scrutiny. At a high-profile U.S. Senate hearing Tuesday, the country was labeled as a tax haven following an investigation into the offshore tax practices of Apple. Now, Britain, France, and other EU countries have long criticized Ireland's tax practices. Well, joining us now on the line to discuss this further, Charlotte MacDonald Gibson, a regular Monocle contributor in Brussels, and David McWilliams, an Irish economist and author, is on the line with us from Dublin. Welcome to you both. Let's start, though, with you, Charlotte, in Brussels. This big meeting happening today. Yesterday, the European Commissioner's President, José Manuel Barroso, again called for this sharing of tax data. What do we expect to come out of today's meeting?
Well, there's going to be a reasonably strong statement at the end of the meeting with the leaders of the 27 members of the EU calling for an acceleration of work in the fight against tax fraud. However, we're not really expecting anything concrete to come out of it today. This piece of legislation known as the Savings Directive, which would allow automatic sharing of bank data between the 27 EU states, that's been languishing unsigned for decades now, and there's no indication that Austria and Luxembourg, which have this long history of banking secrecy, there's no indication they're going to change their position today and will have any sort of concrete steps on that. And the same goes for the issue of the big corporations, which is in the headlines so much in this past week. There's nothing that's going to come out of the summit today which is really going to put any more pressure on the big corporations like Google or Apple on tax matters.
And Charlotte, can I ask you, we've seen lots of manoeuvring over the past years, which has been successful about targeting, you know, proper tax dodgers. People are just hiding money away. And I think there has been some movement, even by the likes of Luxembourg, to be a little bit more cautious and sensible about that. But here we're just talking about tax rates as well. And people perhaps legitimately kind of putting money away, abiding by the laws in these different countries. I understand with Luxembourg, which his whole economy is kind of balanced on top of this huge banking sector. But why are the Austrians, do you think, so concerned also about, you know, not sharing this data?
It's historical, really. It's the same reasons why Switzerland, for example, protects it, because it's very much a part of the national national psyche. Their banks are a big part of the economy as well in Austria. It's not obviously not as swollen as Luxembourg, where it takes up such a huge proportion of the economy, but it's still a very important part of the economy. So there are these concerns that jobs could be at risk if this legislation came into being. So that's very much what both Austria and Luxembourg are negotiating at the moment. They're trying to make sure there are enough caveats within this legislation that would protect their industry. And also for Austrians, it's for Austria, the government, they're very keen to make sure that Austrian citizens don't become part of this as well, so that their data can still be protected while still sharing data of individuals from other EU member states. So it's historic for Austria.
Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson there in Brussels. Let's head now, though, to Dublin to speak to David McWilliams. David, Ireland, the subject of all of this controversy as of late. Apple recorded 65% of its worldwide income in Ireland, despite only having something like 4% of its workforce there. Yesterday, your Deputy Prime Minister, Eamon Gilmore, he defended the tax agreements that Ireland has, saying it was not an issue for the Irish government. Do you think that it should be an issue for the Irish government?
Well, good morning, Phil. I think it is a major issue for the Irish government. I think we are in serious hot water, not necessarily, actually, as a result of the EU summit this morning, but much more, as you referred to yesterday. The testimony of Senator Carr Levin in the US was extraordinary in terms of exposing Apple's shenanigans, frankly, in terms of how much profits and revenue Apple is driving through Ireland and how little tax Ireland is receiving. But it's not just Ireland. If you look at the details of the Apple evidence, it's not only that the United States are not receiving tax, but many other countries where Apple has sales and revenues and production are also not receiving tax. So this seems to me to be the opening salvos of a coming war between the nation state and the taxation authorities in the nation states all around the world, and the global corporation. And I think we have to see this in a much broader light, which is that after 5 years of very low growth, of very subdued recoveries, even in the United States, the issue of the gap between the average guy on the street, and the large corporation, the 1% and the 99%, if you will, is becoming increasingly the background noise for politics. And a country like Ireland, which has sided with explicitly the large corporations against the average guy in the street, both in our own country and abroad, is clearly in the dock. Now, how Ireland reacts to this is, it can go one or two ways. On the one hand, it can take the Millwall approach, which is everybody hates us but we don't care, which is this is our policy and this is the way we go. Or it can take the more contrite approach, which is we will change our stripes. But ultimately, unfortunately, as a citizen of the country, I think Ireland is a tax haven. I think it is more of what could be described as a doormat country where corporations kind of wipe their feet of their tax obligations in Ireland and get things rerouted from Ireland out to other jurisdictions. For example, Google does this with respect to Bermuda. But I do believe this is a very serious problem. I don't believe the teeth of the EU are what the Irish will worry about. I think much more so they'd be worried about Capitol Hill.
Now, David, can I ask you another question, which is, you know, that when you look at the economy of Ireland, yes, you've done slightly better than some of the other nations that really struggled after the banking crisis. But still, you know, Ireland's economy has a long way to go. Now, this is a huge amount of money being pushed through Ireland, and you're taking such a small amount of it. You know, some of it you take no money at all as a state, and I think in other cases we're thinking it's a percentage of 1% or perhaps 2% at the most. So just on a kind of practical level, it doesn't look very kind of astute on the part of the government to allow so much money to be funneled through the country and you to take so little of it by way of payment to help revive your economy.
Andrew, I think you've pointed out something that many Irish people have been frustrated about over the years, which has been the inconsistency between Irish politicians and the establishment in general, trumpeting, as you say, the low tax and the competitive nature of the economy, etc., on the one hand, and on the other hand, offering all the fruits and the gains from this policy to a very, very tiny amount of multinational corporations, whereby the average Irish worker, and I'm talking about the average worker, but the educated Irish worker, simply receives a wage which is taxed at 50% plus, if you think about it, in order to facilitate the ongoing tax avoidance of large corporations who are paying, as we saw in the case of Apple, less than 1% of their total tax revenue.
David, I'm just going to take the opposite view from Andrew and yourself, if I may. You know, Ireland is still a struggling economy. Times are tough, and even if the government does get 1 or 2% from a billions and billions of dollars, that is still a fair chunk of money, isn't it? And if you just say, you know, we're going to raise our taxes, then they're just going to take that money and that tax revenue and give it to another government that are going to be more willing to accept it.
Well, I think you could be right if you believe that the status quo, which is that global corporations can move money around willy-nilly with and simply force smaller countries to engage in aggressive tax avoidance, which is what the European Union are discussing this morning. My own sense is that we're at the beginning of something much, much bigger. And by that I mean we're the beginning of a process which could be a generational process, whereby in the last generation, large multinational corporations were entertained all around the world with low tax, and tax competition became part of countries' competitive strategy. My own sense now is that we may well be moving into an era, and this has come from Starbucks and Google and all the political stuff we saw in the United Kingdom over the last couple of months, into a situation whereby large corporations will have to become more transparent, and nation states, particularly if they want to remain in a family of nations like the European Union, will be not as easily able to engage in beggar my neighbor policies.
David, so thanks. David, sorry to interrupt. Unfortunately, we're just going to have to leave it there. We've unfortunately run out of time. I do appreciate your time, though. David McWilliams joining us from Dublin and Charlotte MacDonald Gibson in Brussels.
Now, here's a question for you, Phil. How do you predict who might become a violent criminal? Well, not sure.
Tell me.
There are some who believe that the drivers behind violent behaviour are almost always social and behavioural.
Interesting. Well, I understand that there are also criminologists and neuroscientists, though, who beg to differ. One of them is Adrian Raine, professor in the Department of Criminology, Psychiatry and Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania.
Professor Raine focuses his research on the neurobiological basis of antisocial behaviour, and his new book, The Anatomy of Violence, he goes even further, exploring the extent to which criminals are born rather than made.
Spooky. Well, to find out how far this theory can go and whether we should reevaluate our whole approach to the prevention of crime and the treatment of criminals, we invited Adrian Raine to Midori House. He spoke to Tom Edwards.
I wanted to tell a story. I really wanted to get out the notion that there really is, in part, a biological and genetic basis to crime because, you know, I think for the past several decades, we're focused on the social factors, you know, which are important, like poverty, unemployment, bad housing, discrimination. And, you know, I'm not trying to argue against that perspective. All I'm saying is that it's two sides of a coin. And I'm trying to turn over the other side of the coin to reveal the biological and genetic factors that also go to shape crime and violence, and that I believe that by opening our perspectives up to the fact that violence is multi-causal, many different factors coming together, we'll be in a far better position to stop it. It's always been, unfortunately, a little bit of a divisive field. I feel that's held us back, however, and that if we could only grasp these neuroethical nettles that are threatening to strangle progress in this field, we would all be better served. And so my intention is to try and get this out on the table. Really, I don't want to make any firm conclusions. I mean, in that last chapter, I do look at these futuristic scenarios, but where may this take us, for better or for worse? But actually, I'm a bit divided myself where I think we should go.
I mean, that's interesting. You mentioned there this thing about predisposition towards certain kinds of offending. It is the stuff almost of science fiction. There's these movies. There's one I saw recently with Tom Cruise picture where there's the Department of Pre-Crime, you know, solving things before they happen.
Minority Report.
Now, should that stay the stuff of science fiction? Or do you think your conclusion suggests that this is genuinely something that nations need to consider exploring?
We definitely need to consider this much further, and more it's coming out that there is added value in taking on board biology to not just understand crime, but even to predict it. Just really quite recently, two new brain imaging studies have come out showing that by looking at brain structure and brain function, we can better predict which prisoners are going to reoffend. Now, first of all, by the way, there'll never be perfect prediction to future offending. But every single day, we make decisions, probation and parole decisions, on which prisoners do we let out early because they're not at risk. And if somebody's committed a crime, well, should we put him in prison or do we let him out on probation? At the moment, we're basing our decisions on dangerousness and risk to society based purely on past behaviour and also social factors, demographic factors like how old they are they male or are they female? What the new research is showing is add biology into the equation and we can make better decisions.
It does strike me, though, that there is a problem in terms of the degree to which you allow that consideration to influence your decisions. Now, perhaps if you're talking about rehabilitation, there's more of a case for it to be one strand of many. But you mentioned the reticence about some on left and right about the issues of how much people can take responsibility, for example. Is it a worry then that you could end up in a situation where people say, well, I'm beyond personal responsibility simply because I'm pre-programmed? My predisposition is to behave in a certain way. Do you think that that's a problem? Or do some people, I mean, there's a number of interesting case studies in the book, are some people simply destined to take this career path of offending?
You know, it's a really good question and a difficult one, I think, for all of us to resolve. I mean, first of all, of course, there's no one-to-one destiny for crime. And I don't believe biology is destiny. I think we can change the biological risk factors that nudge some people into crime. But you're exactly right that for some people, the dice are loaded early in life. And whether it's a combination of bad genes, bad brain functioning, poor housing, bad parenting, we have social and biological factors conspiring together to raise the odds quite substantially that some innocent young babies will become violent criminal offenders.
Do you think the balance is entirely wrong then with the courts? When we look at, for example, maybe a repeat violent offender, should that be looked at? I know in the book you suggest, I mean, that's a clinical disorder then, is it? Is it wrong to even consider that under this sort of criminal courts umbrella? Do we need to involve clinicians? Do we need to look at the biology and the medicine perhaps that would be involved?
I think you're right. And I think it's fascinating, although obviously controversial and a bit on a limb, to think of reconceptualizing repeat criminal offending as actually a clinical disorder that's not really much different to anxiety disorders or depression. I mean, let's take anxiety disorders or depression. They're a combination of genes and the environment. I think violence is a public health problem. And if we begin to take more of a biomedical perspective, not forgetting the social factors, but put all of these things together and think of trying to tackle all these causes in more of a treatment and rehabilitation approach, I think we'd all be better served by such a perspective. But I think many people would not like the idea of construing crime as a clinical disorder.
Adrian Raine there, author of The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime, talking to Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards. Lots more to come in the second half of Midori House, but before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the latest world news.
The search of the ruins left by a huge tornado that hit the U.S. state of Oklahoma is now drawing to a close. Officials have said they are almost certain that there are no more survivors or bodies left to recover. The storm killed 24 people when it tore through a suburb of Oklahoma City. A summit of EU leaders in Brussels today is expected to be dominated by the tax affairs of some of the world's largest companies. It's estimated European nations between them lose around €1 trillion a year through tax avoidance. Yesterday, the head of the technology company Apple appeared before a US Senate committee to reject claims that it was trying to shirk its responsibilities. North Korea has sent a special envoy to China to try to heal relations between the two countries. It follows Beijing's tougher stance on Pyongyang's latest nuclear test and the heightened tension on the Korean Peninsula. Two leading political figures in Iran have been banned from standing in next month's presidential election. One is the former president, Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani. The other is a close ally of the outgoing president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And seven members of Egypt's security forces who'd been abducted in the Sinai Peninsula have been freed. They were seized travelling close to the city of El Arish, but were released after Egypt's president said he wouldn't negotiate with their captors. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. I have no idea why James was on my mind. I wonder who this mystery man is.
We'll find out later.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Andrew Tuck. Paul will be back in about 24 minutes at the top of the hour with another check of the world news headlines. Now, in this week's Entrepreneurs, we'll ask the billionaire founder of Fiji Water why he set his sets on the humble ginger root for his newest venture. We'll get management tips from the CEO of Nokia, and we'll meet India's most successful female entrepreneur.
But in this preview, we're heading to Egypt. With 20 million people and poor infrastructure, Cairo's traffic can be unbearable. But an Egyptian company has found a way to take cars off the streets of Cairo by looking to the Nile. Egypt's oldest transport route, the river, is at the centre of life, but in recent decades has rarely been used for commuting. Nile Taxi is looking to change that, offering Egyptians an opportunity to park their cars and ride on the Nile to work. Rebecca Collard reports from Cairo.
Cairo traffic. This city is home to 20 million residents, and sitting in traffic could be considered a national pastime. Congested, badly planned, and with poor infrastructure, in peak commuting times, it can take up to an hour to move just a few kilometers on the streets of this, Egypt's capital city. I'm on my way to meet Magdi Karolis, one of the entrepreneurs behind Nile Taxi, a new company starting to use Egypt's oldest transport route, the Nile River, to take commuters to and from work. I'm meeting Magdi in Nile City, a multi-tower business complex that sits along the river and hosts thousands of people every week. Until recently, all had to fight traffic on the Corniche to make it to work and appointments. My taxi driver explains. He says he's been driving a taxi in Cairo for 20 years. Since the revolution started here just over 2 years ago, the traffic has gotten worse. Cement walls now block the major thoroughfares downtown. And he says there's no government control of the traffic. I head into the building to meet Magdi.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Rebecca. How are you? This is Magdi.
The Nile is used long time ago as a way of transportation for goods and for passengers. And we have a lot of problems in the traffic, in the Roman traffic in Egypt. So we decided, why not using the Nile as a mean of transportation for passengers? And it was a very good and very idea. I mean, it's the business is growing and people are using it extensively. They go to work with it, they go shopping with it, they go everywhere with it in Egypt now.
The Nile River is Egypt's oldest highway. For the pharaohs, it was key to their economy and society. They used boats to transport people and goods from southern Egypt to the port city of Alexandria, where the Nile flows into the Mediterranean Sea. Millennial paintings show people pushing down the Nile in the simple woven boat used by the pharaohs. Nile Taxi is using speedboats for their routes, and Najdi shows me the diagrams of the specially designed boats now being made for the company.
In this boat, you have 15 people in this boat plus the skipper. It's fast. It's not slow. It can make up to 40 kilometers per hour, but we are using it for 25 kilometers per hour. And you can brand this boat. I mean, it can be brand to anybody, to any big company. We are using the best engines available now. We are using the Hyundai marine engines. Will be installed in it. Very low emissions to take care of, about the environment. We are using very professional sailors, skippers.
There are already a few government-owned passenger boats that crisscross the Nile, but the service is limited and geared towards people who would normally use public transportation. Nile Taxi is different. It's targeting people that would normally commute in their own cars or private taxis.
When we studied the issue of traffics, we found that the vehicle mix in the street is 68 for privately owned cars, and the other were taxis and buses and motorcycles. So if you want to tackle this the problem of traffic, you have to tackle the private only car. So that's what I made. I made a convenient boat for them, for the guys who have cars and who does not take the normal transportation.
Many of the clients are young professionals that work in the city's business center and live in the suburb of Madi, south down the Nile. I head out at 5:30 p.m. to catch the Nile Taxi in Garden City, a neighborhood along the Corniche that also hosts many of Cairo's upscale hotels. I'm taking the boat to Madi. I've done this commute at this hour many times, and it can take more than an hour. The Corniche is bumper-to-bumper traffic. I cross and head down to the dock, leaving the traffic behind me. The Nile Taxi picks me up. We begin speeding down the river. While the streets around us are completely congested, the Nile is almost empty. We head south, passing small farming villages on islands in the Nile, fishermen, and a few other boats. About 15 minutes later, we're already at the dock in Madi. I speak with a few of the passengers. Hazem El Geshi describes what it's like to sit in Cairo traffic.
Sitting in traffic in Egypt is hell, especially and you take a route that should take 15 minutes in an hour or so, it's hell. You're not moving.
Yeah. And how does that feel?
Very frustrating. Those guys missed the boat in the morning. They came at 11. So from 9:15 till 11, I caught the boat at 9. I was there 9:20. So.
And they arrived?
11.
But for Ahmed Mohammed, it's not just saving time, but also an escape from the chaos and congestion of Cairo.
It will save me not less than 3 to 4 hours.
Yeah. And what will you do with that extra time?
Going home earlier, it will give us space for a lot of things. Even staying with the family. And also, it's not only about the road. The mode itself is different. Very relaxing. That's enough. It's not only the saving of time. It is the mode is different also.
Nile Taxi is even having trouble keeping up with the demand as word spreads about the river transport. Eventually, they hope to take thousands of cars off Cairo's streets and put their passengers here, on the Nile. For Monocle in Cairo, I'm Rebecca Collard.
Well, that was very interesting. And if you want to know more about that and what else is happening in the world of business, you just have to tune in to the Entrepreneurs Show at 1900 hours London time. And that, of course, is our show about how to be a business person, how to set up your own business. And it's hosted by Sophie Grove. And that's our weekly show that premieres tonight.
I always do wonder why the Thames isn't utilized more with, you know, ferries and riverboats as a mode of transportation to get from, you know, the east to the west.
Yeah, I think they've tried it a few times. You can commute down to Canary Wharf.
But it's somehow more of a touristy thing, isn't
it? Yeah, more of a touristy thing. And somehow it's a bit chilly on the boat and you're not quite sure what times they're going to leave. It's strange. There was a very good book that came in here the other day which showed what London's rivers looked like just a few years ago, in the 20s. Well, a few years ago, in the 20s and 30s. It was just packed from side to side with boats, with barges. And now it's kind of empty. And then, on that sad note, should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on. I will be heading to the Balkans next with a check of the latest news with our correspondent there, Guy Delaney.
The menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks, and the makers behind these experiences. Each week, we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition, we visit Italy's Slow Fish Trade Fair for new innovative ways of serving fish. Santiago pops into this Midori House Studio One with his basket for the last time. And we visit a restaurant in Istanbul that works hard to uncover Turkey's forgotten food treasures.
In Turkey, you really are your own chef. And the whole principle of meze, these little hors d'oeuvres, is that you make your own plate. You know, you take a little bit of olive oil, and you take something spicy, and you take something salty, and you take something sweet. In a way, it leaves it up to the diner to be the inventive one.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 15:46 in Beijing. It's 11:46 in Abu Dhabi and 9:46 in the morning if you are in Belgrade. And that's where we're going to head to next. Our man there, Guy Delaney, was up here with the latest check of the world. Some of the headlines making news out there in the Balkans. Guy, thanks very much for joining us here on the program. Let's though begin with Kosovo and Serbia. They've, you know, last month they agreed to normalize relations, but apparently there may be some hiccups along the way.
Indeed, the two prime ministers of Kosovo and Serbia are actually in Brussels today. They were there yesterday as well. And they're trying to work out how to make the deal work. It's one thing to make a deal, but then another to actually implement it. And in their case, they've said, OK, we'll normalise relations. And the key stumbling block is what happens to the ethnic Serb community in North Kosovo. There's about 60,000 ethnic Serbs in North Kosovo. They've pretty much been running their own affairs for more than a decade. Pristina, the government of the Republic of Kosovo, wants them to be brought into the mainstream of Kosovo, but of course the North Kosovo Serbs aren't terribly keen on that. Serbia has made the deal to say, yes, okay, we'll allow some integration to happen, but it's how you implement all this, and the two sides are kicking this around in Brussels, quite possibly as we speak.
And tell me, on the ground, what does that division look like? What, you know, is it a religious divide? Is it a cultural divide? Do people, you know, physically look different? Do they divide up in the towns? How does it work, that patchwork on the ground?
You know, it's quite bizarre. The North Kosovo is made out to be one of the most hazardous places you can possibly go to. If you work for an international organization there, you actually get thousands of dollars a month extra in danger money, in effect. There are various people who work for embassies and international organizations who can't get clearance to go there. When you go to the place, it's actually surprisingly normal. In a town like Leposavić, it's about 20,000 people there, very pretty, nestled in the middle of the mountains, and it feels like you're in Serbia. All the people there are ethnic Serbs, and they go on in traditional Serbian ways, having their feast day. It was their feast day last week when I was there, and they were having celebrations in the town for that. And it all feels generally like a part of Serbia. You go a little bit further into Kosovo, you get to Mitrovica, which is a divided town. You've got the north part of the town is where mostly the ethnic Serb community lives. South part of the town is where the ethnic Albanian community lives. It feels a lot more edgy there. People are aware that the situation is in flux. The ethnic Serbs in the north are very concerned that they might be somehow forced out by people moving into their area or otherwise generally finagling them out of their land. And it does feel a lot more edgy there, but there's not this sort of real on-edge feeling that you'd be brought to expect. Generally, people are trying to make the best of their lives as they can, but the uncertainty really weighs down on people. Very high unemployment rates, intermittent water and electricity. That really does feel a lot more edgy there.
And Guy, another story that's grabbed your attention. Now, I've never actually traveled the Western Balkans by rail, but if I did, I think it would be apparently a horrendous situation, not very, very comfortable. Well, that could be about to change with a new deal that's going to be signed tomorrow.
Absolutely, and it's Russia to the rescue. We've heard a lot about China building big railways all over the place, but this time Russia's coming in with the best part of $1 billion worth of funding to refurbish what's known as Corridor 10 in Serbia. Now, this is very interesting because Corridor 10 is actually a great big cross-Europe railway trunk route, if you like, that stretches in part through Serbia and really goes all the way to Asia. It ends in Turkey. And it's been in a terrible state, in part because of the conflict here. The trains have only been able to go at about 60 kilometers an hour, assuming that they run at all. And things can get very, very slow indeed. Now, with this Russian money coming in, it could be about to get a lot better.
And Guy, tell me, why are the Russians so keen on putting up the cash for this? Is this an attempt to bring their goods into Europe?
I think, you know, Serbia is a good friend of Russia, and everybody's aware of this, and this actually all plays into what's happening with Kosovo and Serbia. That's all part of Serbia's efforts to get into the European Union. Russia wants to remain friends with Serbia. It's a nice little foothold for it to have this relationship with Serbia, putting in this money. Well, yeah, sure, certainly it's part of improving the transport generally in the region, but there's more sort of geopolitical stuff going on here as well.
And Guy, just give us some kind of a bit more human side of the story. Just give us a picture of what it's like when you jump on one of the trains at the moment.
Yeah, well, I got a train from Zagreb to Belgrade, and now that's a fairly straightforward journey by car, about three and a half hours. On train, you know, it could be anything. It's scheduled to be 7.5 hours. The train didn't even depart until half an hour after the scheduled time. They were busy putting the carriages together. You get on, you're gasping for a cup of coffee after a few hours. Bad luck, no buffet car, no water in the toilets either. You've actually got to wait to come to the border station of Sheep, where an old man gets on with a tray with plastic cups of Turkish coffee. I've never been so glad to see a cup of coffee in my life.
It doesn't sound very glamorous, does it? Very quickly, one more story. It's the 20th anniversary of the death of Sarajevo's Romeo and Juliet.
That's right. Boško Berkić was an ethnic Serb. His girlfriend, Admira Ismić, was a Bosniak Muslim in Sarajevo. They were trying to leave that city in 1993 when they were shot dead. They'd been boyfriend and girlfriend for 7 or 8 years. And the people responsible have never been identified. It's the 20th anniversary of it. It's, again, highlighting the fact that country is still very much ethnically divided. One of the top old Yugoslav rock bands who were forced to disband, funnily enough, because of that conflict. They were based in Sarajevo and they were sort of scattered. Has released a song called Boško I Admira, which is in memory of them. U gradu ispod Trebevića. Ali Boško I Admira,
to je već bila filmska priča. Guys, so I guess it will be wait and see to see if it will be a billboard hit on the charts or not. I'm not so sure, but a lovely story at that. Guy Delaney, Monocle's man there in the Balkans, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. It's time now to turn to the Brazilian front pages. We're joined by Monocle researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, it's weird having you here not speaking about Eurovision.
What a shame. I can always talk about Eurovision if you want.
No, but you have
Let's not.
next year in Denmark.
Okay.
You've got the front page of O Globo here for us.
Exactly. Well, I was going to start, actually, if you don't mind, with Folha de São Paulo. Something more serious, because then let's wait for the fun later.
You've got to pace yourself, though.
It was the first one
I know, well, don't. Let's be led by Fernando. Okay,
basically, there's the front page of Folha de São Paulo saying that the police officers who manage to reduce crime in their areas, they'll get a bonus from the government of São Paulo. But, I mean, I can tell you, I don't think that's a good idea, because I think this will lead to more police violence in the streets, which is already quite high in Brazil. And I mean, I don't think that's a good solution. I think they should do like an effort for everyone to kind of to reduce crime, because this is part of the new anti-violence package from the governor of São Paulo, which includes hiring new police officers, investigators. And unfortunately, I have to say that São Paulo did improve the violence rates. But in the last year or so, actually, this violence rate, it seems to be increasing again. So I think that's a bit worrying.
And what's the big target of this? Are they mainly after kind of street crime? Are they after robberies? I know that, you know, having been to São Paulo and actually heading there in a few weeks again with Monocle, you know, that people are, they do extraordinary things to protect themselves every day. I remember being in a car with a woman who's, you know, she had the most rubbish car, a very wealthy woman. She said she wouldn't take a smart car on, you know, on her own ever out. She had a kind of fake handbag that she used to put on the seat next to her in case somebody came up to the car, and she always put her real handbag in the boot. You know, you thought this is an elaborate way to get through your day. Is this the kind of crime that they're trying to target at the moment in São Paulo?
They as well, you know, but I think they're trying to target as well, like the poorer areas, you know, in the favelas where there's still a lot of crime with drugs. But you're right, Andrew, you know, and actually there's a lot of people in Brazil, there's been an increase in panic rooms. Do you know you know, when robbers, actually I know a few people have panic rooms and they're not extremely wealthy. So even kind of a middle class, they would never imagine to buy a panic room here in England or in France. They do that in Brazil, actually. So it's quite a big market.
Well, we did another good story, which was about the sales of safes in Brazil and in Sao Paulo. It's an extraordinary number of people who have a proper safe in their house just because people are so concerned about robbery there.
But at the same time, as I said, you know, the violence rates, they did drop very sharply in the last 10 years. But unfortunately, there's been a...
Now, you've got another story from that paper, which is about the use of quotation marks.
Exactly. It's a very funny, actually, feature that Folha de São Paulo did with two of their columnists. One of them saying that, actually, he see the quotation marks in foreign words as a little bit xenophobic. They said that the words, they kind of need... It's like they're used as a passport. And another one makes fun of those quotation marks. Like, people, they're saying, like, too many English words in the Brazilian press, like foodie, factoring, coaching. So it's been quite an interesting discussion about that. And I have to say, if you read a Brazilian paper or Brazilian magazine, there's so many English words on it. We're not like the French. We actually do use quite a lot of English in our day-by-day language, and it's increasing every day more.
So they're arguing that they shouldn't use these English words as much and just stick to Portuguese. Is that right?
Not really. Actually, one of the colonists, Antonio Prata, is saying that actually they don't need quotation marks. I think they can be incorporated to the language. So it was kind of saying, I mean, let's be open to the new. You know, they don't need this quotation marks.
Well, I guess
marks.
Brazil, unlike Portugal in a way, it's used to kind of absorbing so many different cultures and so many different people that words kind of slip in and out of usage, which are from other languages, much more easily.
Exactly. I agree with Antonio Prata. I don't think we need quotation marks.
But it's
words.
Good to know that when I'm saying foodie, factoring, coaching, I'm speaking Portuguese.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Your Portuguese is amazing, Andrew.
You're so trilingual.
But just to end, I have a cute little very story quickly. For us. Okay, 50 new birds were discovered in the Amazon, and that's the biggest ornithology discovery in the last 140 years. I'm very excited about that. Look at those cute little birds.
Oh my God.
My favorite is this one, and actually he's got a very complicated name.
I think that's a budgerigar.
Well, we'll continue this discussion elsewhere outside of this studio.
I would call Chorozinho do Aripuanã.
Unfortunately, all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producers, Annabel Bly and Barbara Feeney, and our Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our studio manager, and of course, Chris Fitch. Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.